Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to New Books in Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast. I'm your host, Crawford Gribben, and today my guest is Robert Elmer. Robert is a communications specialist at Seattle Pacific University. He's a prolific author of over 50 books, and today we're speaking to Robert about one of his most recent publications, an edited volume, Piercing Heaven, Prayers of the Puritans, just published by Lexham Press. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Congratulations on the book. It's a really beautiful production, not only in the way it's put together, like so many of the Lexham Press books I've seen recently, but also in its content. What's the background to this book? A most unusual topic, the topic of Puritan prayers.
Right. This was actually a longtime dream of my editor at Lexham Press here in Bellingham, Washington. We're north of Seattle on the Canadian border, but he had long been a fan of the Valley of Vision volume, which is, of course, a classic popular book on the same subject here in the U.S., I believe worldwide, though it's long been out of print. So my editor was also acquainted with the work that I'd done in updating another spiritual classic, which I edited several years ago, called Practicing God's Presence. And that's a modern-day language update of the practice of the presence of God by Brother Lawrence. So we got together, and I came to this with a background in Christian devotional literature as well as in community journalism and editorial marketing as a novelist. If that's an odd combination, it had been a passion of mine to reintroduce contemporary readers to classics like this. So that's where Piercing Heaven came from.
Fascinating. Now, tell us a little bit more, both about your interest in spirituality, but also about your fiction writing.
Okay. The fiction writing came some years ago when my own children were young, and they were starting to read books, just picking up things from the library. And I looked at some of those books, and I thought, you know, maybe I could do something like this too. And the stories came out of stories my own grandmother and parents had told me under the occupation years in World War II. They're all from Denmark. So I put together a historical fiction account of a family living in Denmark and how they dealt with hiding the Jews in 1943. And that became the first of a series of novels for young probably 8 to 12 year olds. And I enjoyed doing that for a number of years. It grew into other series, mostly historical based, and then a few books for grownups along the way, and the occasional nonfiction book as well. And I drew on my journalism background to start writing these, and got a lot of help along the way, and it was an enjoyable time.
So you've obviously written a great deal, Robert. I take it writing is part of your daily routine?
Writing is part of my job right now. Yes, I'm a communications specialist at Seattle Pacific University, which is a Christian college in Seattle. So I am able to write articles for the alumni magazine and for marketing materials, a little bit of different kind of writing here. So I get to exercise different kinds of writing muscles along the way, but a little bit of variety as well. And I get to write websites, brochures, all that, marketing materials too.
And you've done a little bit of teaching fiction writing as well, haven't you, over the years?
That came out of the historical fiction novels for children. I was asked to join a group that went around the United States and put on writing seminars for mostly small private schools, also homeschool groups. Occasionally a public school would ask us to do that. And so I developed some workshops on fiction writing, plots, characters, writing essentials and all that, and had a fun time teaching young kids doing that. Don't do it currently, but if more of novels come along the way, that'd be another fun avenue. I enjoyed that a lot. Along the way, previous to that, I'd received a teaching credential for elementary age, so I was able to put that to use. But mostly my career has been in writing.
Wonderful. Everyone's dream job, I think, that listens to this podcast. So you've edited this book of Puritan Prayers. As we begin to think about the book, should we relate it to your Brother Lawrence project? Is it going to perform a similar kind of exercise, or is it intended to help people think about spirituality?
I would say yes and no. Just in the way that the Brother Lawrence book was written, we took more of a, if anyone's familiar with the Message version of the Bible, which is a paraphrased version, it takes on that kind of a style. It's very contemporary, possibly over the top contemporary. It's designed to really bring an ancient set of letters into contemporary language, and I made efforts to do that. Piercing Heaven is a little bit more, I would say, dialed back. I was careful not to take too many liberties with the language, merely bringing it up to contemporary usage. And but the yes part of that answer is that, yes, they're both designed as devotional literature, so something that someone could pick up and enjoy in their prayer life, enjoy just reading. And it's designed, I think, with the original writings, to they're taken out of sermons often, those prayers, which is where I was able to find most of the prayers. They're in written sets of sermons, so they're designed to encourage Christians and non-Christians along the way in their prayer life.
So before we jump into the book itself, Robert, would you read us one of your favorite prayers that you've included in this anthology?
I can do that, yeah. Just leafing through the book here, I found a rather short one. And we could talk later about how the book is organized. But this one here is by a pastor named Richard Aline. And it's entitled, "Give Me a New Heart." Here's how it goes. My Lord, bring me to the place where you eat. Let me live before your face. Let me feel your smiles upon my heart. Let me love you and tell me you love me. Remember me. Take pity on me. Accept me. Care for me. And then choose my condition, my home, and my sources of sustenance. Give me a new heart, Lord. I am tired. You also are tired. My wicked heart. Make it easier for yourself and for me by taking away this heart and giving me a better one. Lord, spread your sweet ointment. Let the smell of your garments refresh my soul. Let me taste and see. Let me see, and I will taste that the Lord is gracious. Amen.
Now, when we think about Puritans, Robert, we tend to have certain kinds of stereotypes in mind, don't we? Of black-hatted, broad-brimmed, sour-faced scrutinizers of their peers. As you work through the material in this book, How did your perception of Puritanism develop?
I think that was the biggest surprise for me, because I think that is the common perception of what the Puritans would be like. Here in the States, we have a popular breakfast cereal company called Quaker Oats, and the picture of the Quaker these days is smiling, but for many years I think was not. And I think that's the perception of these people, these Puritans. They wore these hats and they were killjoys and they were against everything. Now, I looked for those people in these writings when I was doing the research, and I could not find them. I found instead Puritan prayers that were in many instances energetic, emotional, heart-shaking, and they were neither casual nor perfunctory, but they were praises from a position of deep humility, and they were taking every aspect of life into their prayers. They're others-centered, for the most part, perhaps more so than a typical modern prayer, although they could also be deeply introspective. And I think these people were serious, yes, and they were seriously dedicated to their work, and their prayers reflected that in their all-in commitment. But these people were obviously on their knees, and they held back nothing back from their sermons, and the length of which, if they were offered in a church setting in 2020, would probably scare off even the most serious of churchgoers. But I looked for the dourness. I looked for the seriousness. I looked for the killjoy in these people. And perhaps it existed. Perhaps there's a reason for that stereotype. But in my research, I could not find them.
Mm. So what does it mean then, to go back to your subtitle there, Prayers of the Puritans, what does it mean to pray like a Puritan?
I think it means that the prayers are so serious that they take in the heart of life. These are people that I think did not go to church just on Sunday mornings. They lived a faith that was vital and had meaning to them every day of the week. So to pray like a Puritan, I believe, is to expose yourself to a serious faith that encompasses more of life than just a casual, hey, I'm headed to church for an hour and I'll be back and then we'll live our lives. But it was more of a lifetime commitment on a day-to-day basis, and praying like a Puritan is an emotional experience. It's a humbling experience. It's a deeper experience than the casual reciting of a written prayer. So it's in that sense, it's perhaps a little intimidating for a person of a modern faith who doesn't want to commit to that. But these were very committed people, and everything they saw through the lens of their faith. So they prayed that way.
Mm. Now, they're serious people, and you've drawn here on prayers from quite a number of different contributors, haven't you? Were there any contributors whose work you especially admired?
You know, that's interesting. I did not come into this project as a historian or as an expert in theology even. I came into it as an editor and a novelist, a storyteller. I was looking for stories. I was looking for people who were telling true stories from their lives. So I didn't have a favorite, really. I think during the course of the research, there were some that I found more compelling than others, certainly. But I don't know that I actually developed a real favorite along the way.
Well, Robert, could you tell us a little bit about the contributors that you've drawn upon for this volume? How many, where they come from, anything about their background?
Right. There are a number of contributors here that
come from all spectrums of the theology of the day. Some of them a little more on the Reformed side, some of them a little less so. I would say that there were 16 contributors, all of them men. I did include one woman in here. She was a poet. I could talk about that. There were 31 men, 31 men and one woman. A few of them are names that some people have heard about them. Most of them probably not. I did compile a list of short bios in the back. There was people like Richard Aline, who was a British pastor who traveled around England with the grandfather of John and Charles Wesley. But he did get in trouble for not adhering to the Conformity Act of 1662, which was a law designed, as you know, to standardize church ritual at the time, among other things. So it was more of a, you do the prayer in this order, you follow the script, there's no deviation. And I suppose there were many pastors who lost their jobs at the time for not lining up with that act. Richard Baxter was another pastor from the mid-1600s who found himself in trouble with the law. And he wrote a couple of classics that are still available today. Lewis Bailey was an earlier Puritan, born in 1575. He was a rector of St. Matthew's Church in London. Then he was a bishop, and then he was persecuted and put in prison for his Puritan views. He wrote a book that deeply influenced John Bunyan, by the way. And John Bunyan himself, who wrote, of course, Pilgrim's Progress, spent 12 years in prison for his faith. One of my favorites was, you asked about favorites there. One of my favorites was Robert Hawker, who is known for his passionate preaching and his heart for the poor. And in fact, he wrote what was called the Poor Man's Devotionals and Commentaries series, which was one of Charles Spurgeon's favorites. And Spurgeon endorsed those books, loved those books. And the one woman that I mentioned in Piercing Heaven, her name was Anne Bradstreet, and she was a particular interest to American historians. She was the first poet to have her works published in the British North American colonies. And she came to America in 1630 from England with her Puritan husband and her father. And her first poems were actually published in England without her knowledge or consent, but they became very popular nonetheless. So they do cover a spectrum. Most of these Puritans wanted to keep the church pure from within, and they did pay a price for that. Some of them edged more toward a separatist sentiment, or they found themselves there by default. A few of them were able to bridge the gap and stay out of prison that way. But they were all very committed people, and they're worth remembering. I hope my intention was that the prayers in this book would show us a little more of a window into the kind of people that they were, into the kind of Christians that they were. And I think in the United States, and I'm not sure how true it is in the UK, it's probably the same thing, or Europe in general, I think it's fair to say that we're quite untethered from our past. We don't think about what past generations believed very much or why they believed it, to our detriment. We seldom recognize the unseen values of even a spiritual heritage. And I think that's true in the church at large. But that's part of American culture in particular. Old is bad, new is good. Each generation tends to believe that they're the first, little knowing that the threads that tie them to language or culture or belief. So this book is an attempt to shine a light on some very deep influences in our church, if only we would take a closer look. But at the same time, I'm also dedicated as an editor to readability in the belief that the battle to uncover spiritual heritage is lost from the start if the language is unapproachable. So that was my number one task here, is to produce a book that brought to life some of these people and provided a bridge for modern readers, yet at the same time was approachable enough for casual readers, lay readers. It's not a scholarly book, but I wanted it to be something that is approachable and digestible and understandable. And along the way, people having read some of these prayers would perhaps find themselves understanding or identifying more with people who lived hundreds of years ago.
Hmm. So you mentioned editing methods there, Robert. Could you tell us a little bit more about, firstly, where you found the prayers, and secondly, what you did to them after you found them?
Okay. Well, I enjoyed the entire process. As an editor and a writer, the research was fascinating. I learned so much. And I'm sure that this is no news to scholars in the field, but as a layperson, I was surprised and pleased to discover that so many 400-year-old, 500-year-old manuscripts actually still existed and online. Most of my research happened to be online. I started out with a list of known Puritan writers, authors, pastors, bishops, and I mentioned some of them before, but then we went down the list and we searched out some of the most obscure, forgotten sermon and book manuscripts that we could find. And of course, many of them were scans of printed sermon collections, and some of them were very challenging to read, especially for me, given that I'm a lay editor. I'm not an expert in this field, but just looking at some of those scans, the faded print quality, the old script, the page-long sentences, the antiquated vocabulary, it was a challenge for me, but a good challenge. They have been, in many cases, scanned and forgotten, perhaps not so much by the scholarly world, but by the general public, of course. And that was my calling, not to present an interesting thesis or a scholarly premise, but to bridge the gap between the world of Puritan Christendom and today's churchgoer. So practically speaking, and this is the news editor in me, the storyteller, the novelist, over the course of better part of a year, this was a weekend and evening job for me, I combed through these sermons and writings, and my approach was basically to search for keywords. And that's what made it a little bit easier for me, because we had our topic narrowed to prayers. I wasn't just searching for topics. I was open to many topics. Whatever they were praying about was up for discovery. So it was a wonderful exercise, really. I prospected for words and phrases throughout these scanned documents. Just search amen, search O Lord, search I pray, my prayer is, a number of phrases like that. And it called for a good deal of searching, but it was a like I said, a fun exercise. So the prayers would pop up sometimes in the middle of a sermon that was written as a collection of sermons. Typically, if it were a pastor that had some kind of reputation, they would take the written sermons, and after the person's death, maybe 100 years later, they would publish it. So we had a lot of these published sermon collections from the 1700s, 1800s that were scanned, and then I'm going through them. And the prayers would pop up sometimes in the middle of a sermon, sometimes at the end, and they would be anywhere from a few sentences, an extemporaneous prayer, to prayers that span perhaps several pages. And then I would have to go through that and select portions, out of which my assignment was to find the gems. So I did not differentiate in the research on the basis of a specific pastor or a specific author. And in other words, I honestly had not enough initial awareness of who these people were. And I'm being completely honest here, but I was looking for prayers. So I did not have a preconceived notion of their content, their potential depth, or even of the authors themselves. I wasn't looking for specifics. I was just seeing what I could find. And certainly I could research and learn more about the sermon writers. And this I did to some extent. That was not my primary purpose. I suppose you could call me a prayer archaeologist of sorts. So ultimately I simply collected the prayers. I edited them. I carefully updated the language, because some of it was language that we no longer use. And even though the words looked familiar, they're used in different ways. So I did a little research just to be careful and to make sure that I was faithfully reproducing what they were saying. But I took care not to make it sound so contemporary that it would be jarring. I tried to give it a light touch in updating it just to reflect contemporary usage, and collected them. And then along the way, the categories over the course of several months, they began to I began to look for patterns in content. So the prayers in this book are arranged by topic in general because of the devotional purpose of the volume. So the publisher intended that Christians might find the prayers both interesting and helpful, but even more as apt for use in personal study and prayer. So they serve as a window into the Puritan mind, but they also serve as, I mentioned, I use the word bridge a lot. They serve as a bridge, as an approachable way to kind of compare contemporary spirituality with that of church leaders in the 17th century. So we arrange them by category. So I'm looking here at the beginning of the book here, and we have the categories of prayers. Help me to ask for help. Help me through my doubts. Help me through my time of sadness and suffering. So there'd be prayers there about when there's sickness and praying for a dying father. Help me to endure temptation. Help me to rest in God's love. I believe. Help my unbelief. Prepare my heart for the Lord's day and the Lord's table. Help me to begin the day. Help me to live the day. Help me to close the day. Help me to praise and thank. Forgive my sins. Help me to give the gospel to others. So by category, these, when I was assembling the prayers, they would, we naturally herded them into those baskets. And, that's the way the book turned out. So our hope was that a contemporary parishioner, someone today, might read the prayers and find value in what is common or with resonates with their situation today. And also perhaps as a way to, fill in the gaps in their own spirituality. And yeah, go ahead.
I think that's exactly what makes these prayers so valuable for scholars as well, isn't it? Because so many Puritans were opposed to writing down prayers, but here we have them captured, discovered, and edited for us to make them as accessible as they possibly could be. Robert, just as we come to the end of our time together, would you read us another one of the items you included in this anthology?
I'd be happy to do that. Here's one by a man named Isaac Ambrose, and it's titled Renew Me in Grace. And we came up with the titles of those prayers. They didn't specifically have titles on their prayers, but they sometimes accidentally slip them in by topic here. So here's how the Isaac Ambrose's prayer goes. Oh Lord, I have no graces by nature. I have no power to cleanse my own heart. I have defaced your image, but I cannot repair it. I can say with the apostle that when I want to do well, evil is present with me, but I find no means to do what I desire. Oh, when will I be set free to do the work of God and run the race of his commands? If only I had hope, joy, and love. Lord, I've heard of your power. You call things that are not as if they were. If you desire it, you can work in me these graces just as gloriously you created them in Adam. Lord, I have also heard of your grace and truth. You are as faithful to keep as you are generous to make these precious promises. Your grace is unsearchable. Your word is purer than silver, seven times refined. Oh, make good your promises. Replenish me with your grace. Amen.
Wonderful. And thank you, Robert. We've taken up a lot of your time today, but before we wind up, could you tell us what project you're working on next?
I am buried in coronavirus work right now. At the university, we are, like many universities around the country, United States, and around the world, dealing with the plague. And I know you were asking me about a writing project. My writing projects are centered around the university's work right now, and I'm fully involved with that. We're trying to figure out how to enable students to work remotely. And so a lot of the writing I'm doing right now is to students, news about the corona crisis on our website. It's a whole new world for us. So that is what my focus is right now. I would like to write some more historical fiction in the future, again, for probably a younger audience. I have in mind a biography of a Danish pastor who was killed during World War II for his anti-Nazi sentiments, a pastor named Kai Munk. And I'm gathering up material slowly. That'll be a multi-year project, but biography has been written about him in English. Many have been written in Danish. But since my background is that, that's a particular interest for me.
That sounds important on both counts. Thank you for coming on to the show today, Robert, and being willing to talk about Piercing Heaven. Thanks for your time, and take care.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you taking time, and it was enjoyable.
It's a pleasure. Thanks to everyone else for listening in today. I'll see you next time on New Books in Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast.